Good evening to all our attendees and our virtual viewers on Facebook. Thank you so much for joining us today and welcome to our virtual panel on the highs and lows of cannabis law reform. This is presented by EJP at the University of Auckland in collaboration with the Auckland District Law Society. We appreciate you tuning in. Thank you so much. So I just want to start by introducing myself. My name is Horia and I am co-manager of the Access team.
Hi there, my name is Jonathan and I'm also a co-manager of the Access team. One of the projects that we undertake in the Access team with the Equal Justice Project are these panel discussions, which usually would be held in person, but unfortunately we weren't able to this year. But we're hoping that the online format makes things a bit more accessible. So yeah, again, thank you all for joining us. So a bit of a rundown on the panel. It'll consist of a series of questions and points put together by some of the members of the Access team, and also informed by questions that we've seen in the media and in the public in general. So tonight we will be hosted and moderated by Professor Mark Hennigan. So I'll pass back to Faria to give a little introduction.
Yes, so our MC for tonight, Mark Hennigan, is a professor of the University of Auckland Law School with particular expertise in family law. He is also a former dean of the University of Otago Faculty of Law and leads New Zealand Authority on International Developments in Family Law. He's also, just adding to accomplishments, on the editorial boards of Child and Family Law Quarterly, the leading United Kingdom Journal on Children's Issues, and the International Journal of Human Rights, the leading United Kingdom Journal on Human Rights. He's very accomplished, and we're very excited to have you here today, Mark. I'll just pass it on to you, and you can introduce the other panellists. Thank you.
Kia ora koutou, everyone. It's great to... Can't see you, but I know you're out there. And I want to say a big thanks to Huria and Jonathan. They've persevered through all the permutations we've all had to live through, and they've made sure that tonight happened, and they've been an absolute joy to work with. So thank you to them and the Equal Justice Project at the University of Auckland. Congratulations. So we have a fantastic panel tonight. I'm very excited to see the panel. I'll start with you, Kylie, Associate Professor Kylie Quince from Auckland University of Technology, formerly also at Auckland University Law Faculty. Kylie is absolutely internationally famous and also a great researcher and a fantastic teacher. Kylie's led research in New Zealand for a number of years, particularly on the impact the criminal justice system has on Māori, and it's a really important issue, and I'm sure Kylie will raise it with us today. She understands it well in all aspects of the criminal justice system. She's done a lot of work in the cannabis area, but she's also done a lot of work on imprisonment. She's done a lot of work on whether prohibition works or doesn't work, so she's done a lot of work. She's also an internationally and nationally awarded teacher. In 2014, she won a great award for being an outstanding excellence in her teaching, and she's won awards at teaching at both Auckland University and AUT. And we're delighted to see you, Kylie, and you're always available to do these things. And I know you've got a home full of people you've got to look after, but you're giving up your time tonight, so that's fantastic. And I'll go to the other lawyer here, James Farmer, who's a very famous QC, probably New Zealand's leading QC, I would say. James has done almost everything there is to do in the courts. He's also got a PhD from Cambridge, a lot of people probably don't realise, which won the York Prize, which is quite amazing. He can practice in the Australian courts. He's practiced in Hong Kong. He's an outstanding QC. I don't know how he finds the time to do these things, but he's found the time to write some articles about his point of view. And I know he'll be forthright, and like all QCs are, and very eloquent in explaining it to us. And we have two wonderful people here from Massey University, and I'm just delighted to see them because I know of their work, and I've been doing some background reading in this area, and I know of their work, and they are absolutely brilliant. They are from the Fariki unit at Massey University, and they specialise in lots of areas, but one of the areas that Chris and both Marta specialise in is the area of drug policy, and they've had... Chris has had published lots of material. He's also done lots of research on the impact of drug policies, all aspects of drug policy. So we're very fortunate to have him today. He knows all aspects, the monetary, the health, the justice, all aspects of it. He's been invited to talk in Europe and the USA about drug policy, and I've seen him also in the media talk on it. So great to have you here, Chris, and your knowledge will be such a big help to everyone here. And Dr. Marta Rike, there you go. She covers both bases tonight. She's got a PhD in... public health from Massey University, and she's also got a Masters of Law from Lisbon. So she's a dually qualified person for tonight's debate. She's also just working on and she's also worked in the European system of monitoring drugs. So she's had experience in a monitoring system. She's also got a Master, and she's working on a Master on recreational and medicinal cannabis. And so she's working right at the coalface. So I don't think we could get a better group of four people than we've got tonight. So what I want to kick off with, because I think it's important to get an overview from each speaker. Most of you will know that you'll be voting very soon on whether you want the cannabis law reform to go through. You'll have a yes or no vote in that situation. And hopefully tonight will inform you greatly. So what I'm going to do is get each speaker to talk about what they think are the highs, the good things about cannabis reform, and also the potential lows. So we've got a big picture, and then we'll dig down into those pictures. So I'll start with you, Kylie. So kia ora, Kylie. So can you give us a little 10-minute overview of your perspective on what you think are the highs of cannabis law reform and what you think are the potential downsides that we could do even better or not do it at all? Over to you, Kylie.
Well, kia ora tātou. Thank you for that, Mark. Kia ora tātou to fellow panellists and to those of you watching out there in Facebook world. So in the interest of disclosure, I'll talk about the three hats really that I wear, that I bring to this kaupapa. So one, as Mark said, I'm a criminal justice advocate. That's my area of research and teaching. But I'm also Māori, and I'm also the mother of three teenagers. So three areas in which there is obviously an interface with both drug use and, of course, the potential of drug law reform. But I'm also the deputy chair of the New Zealand Drug Foundation Board. So obviously we're an NGO that deals with thinking about harm reduction in drug use. So really quickly then, for my 10 minutes, if I think broadly about what cannabis law reform can mean in respect of those three or four hats that I wear. In the justice space, as a lawyer, I think the first thing I could say is that the current prohibition regime doesn't work. So from a rule of law perspective, and particularly in criminal law, when we're talking about prohibition in relation to particular behaviours, you would hope that the law appropriately reflects public mandate, which means that the law should reflect what people think is an appropriate limit on things that we can and can't do, and also that people, in a large sense, of course, it's not prescriptive, but you know, that it does in some way reflect people's behaviour. So what we can say from our prohibition in relation to cannabis law is that it doesn't work, because we know that 80% of New Zealanders try cannabis at some stage in their lives. Around 20% of them use regularly, and the overwhelming majority of people don't use to any problematic levels. So the fact that people use means that its illegal status doesn't put them off, and also that its illegal status is not necessarily a barrier to them finding that product. So that's somewhat problematic. So I think that's one good reason for putting this back, you know, our 40-year-old piece of legislation, putting it back to the public for some mandate, or, you know, at least review and to let the electorate have their say about it. As Māori, I would say that obviously we've borne the brunt of the harms associated with cannabis, and I mean not just the justice harms in terms of being more likely to be stopped, prosecuted, charged, convicted and imprisoned for cannabis use, possession, and then obviously the higher end criminal offences in relation to growing and supplying. So we've borne the brunt of those justice harms. We've also borne the brunt of health harms. So in terms of cannabis use disorder and problematic use, Māori twice as likely as other New Zealanders to use. And then the social harms associated with all of those things. So the stigma of conviction, and then the corollary, what we call the corollary consequences of conviction, which include, you know, inability to find a job, to keep a job, issues in relation to seeking health outcomes or interventions for problematic use. Other consequences of conviction obviously relating to travel and ability to get on with your life. So criminal convictions are serious things, and things that happen when you may have been done as a 17-year-old for possession of cannabis, for example, so the lowest level kind of drug offence, is that those things can affect your life and your ability to get on with your life forever. As a mum of teenagers, I'm particularly concerned about the illegal status of cannabis being related to the ways in which school boards in particular, so governance entities and education, respond differently to cannabis purely on the basis, in my view, purely on the basis of its illegal status. So as I've been a board member of school boards for 30 years, I can see that my fellow board members respond to young people who appear before boards who use cannabis, respond to them differently than they do for young people who smoke tobacco and young people that drink alcohol. Those are all social problems, but there's a differentiated outcome purely on the basis of its illegal status. It makes people freak out. And I think if it was legalized, then that would allow people to think really clearly about a health not handcuffs or a health not punitive kind of response. So although we've seen some improvement in recent years for school boards of not standing young people down or excluding people from school for drug use, it is still a problem in some particularly more conservative areas. Other things in relation to health, so I would like to also put on the board that I think it's unhelpful to think about to pose this kind of sort of binary, if you like, of therapeutic benefits from medicinal cannabis. We've seen some talk in the media recently that we've already legalized medicinal cannabis. And we've seen some pushback recently that the medicinal cannabis regime relies upon the cooperation of medical professionals who are willing and able to prescribe under that regime. And also currently that regime only legalizes two products, and they're both incredibly expensive. So it doesn't allow for people there are a lot of people that would want to use the therapeutic benefits of cannabis without having to use pharmaceutically derived products rather than just the organic product. So I do want to say, I think one of the benefits of the proposed bill, of the legalization and control bill, is that it allows for, I think it's an unhelpful distinction to think about medicinal versus recreational use of cannabis. There are many people that would never go to the doctor for what they for a prescription for, say, low-level anxiety or a sleep aid or some of the other benefits that we might, it's unhelpful to try to ascribe the benefits of cannabis or the reasons people want to use cannabis into one of those camps or another. So I think the medicalization issue is a bit of a red herring. The cons, if I have a couple of minutes to talk about the cons. So I do think there's benefits for Māori in terms of, to summarize the benefits for Māori to move away from negative criminal justice outcomes, particularly conviction and criminalization and imprisonment, health outcomes in terms of responding to sometimes the stigma of addiction to illegal substances means that people are probably less likely to seek help. But in a pragmatic sense, there's also less likely to be those responses, health responses and interventions available to you. So wearing again a law reform policy cap, there's a sort of well-known policy of justice reinvestment, which is the reinvestment of justice monies that are placed into enforcement of prohibition, hundreds of millions of dollars spent on that, which could be diverted to health-based responses. And that's one of the things that the bill intends to do, which is diversion of tax monies derived from legally sold cannabis. Some of the risks, however, there are risks. It is jumping into a big unknown. So again, wearing a legal hat, one of the risks is that prohibition is really easy from a legal perspective, at least in the terminology. Really simple piece of law. You can't do that thing. You can't have it, you can't smoke it, you can't share it. It's really easy. Regulation and legalization is incredibly difficult. Doesn't matter what substance or behavior you're talking about, but allowing people to do things and attempting to put parameters or regulation around use of a thing or a type of behavior is actually quite difficult. So that's a risk. And the devil is in the detail. Are we able to regulate appropriately, whether we're talking about the tax end of things, the legal market end of things, that's going to be quite quite difficult. There is also the risk of normalization of use, which I'm sure James and maybe others will talk about, is that if we're going to think about a link between legalization and increased use, the bill is making a pitch for not only harm reduction, but also somewhat conflicting goals of harm reduction and legalization and an open market that will attempt to have some social equity outcomes. All of those things don't fit really nicely together. So it's trying to do a number, achieve a number of goals. And I think that's quite difficult. But normalization of use, I think, is particularly problematic, notwithstanding that the bill does propose a regime in which cannabis use in any way, shape or form will remain unlawful for under 20s. So but will we be able to do that when over 20s are able to legally use? That is a risk, and I would concede that. There is also the conflict with our other public health goals, such as smoke-free 2025. Of course, that's not an insurmountable barrier because you don't necessarily have to smoke cannabis. In the proposed regime, you do, because we're only initially going to legalize the organic leaf product. But of course, there's a possibility of not allowing smoking by opening up other products such as edibles. So I think that's probably close to my 10 minutes, is it, Mark? So
perfect, Kylie. Now, what a fantastic overview. Thank you, Kylie, and so eloquently put. You can see why she's won the teaching awards. Dr. Chris, Associate Professor Wilkins from Massey University, I'll get you to, you're coming from a different point of view, but you've done so much wide research in all aspects, so I'd love to hear what you have to say as an opening.
Yeah, good evening, everyone, and thank you for inviting me. So what I thought would be good to do is just, so firstly, I should say that generally our views impartial. So we're trying to just provide people and make them aware of the evidence that's around to help them make a decision, because we really believe that, you know, reasonable people can disagree on this issue, and really the role, you know, whatever evidence they have, at the end of the day, they'll apply their own value system about how they decide on this issue. So one of the areas that we've been looking at is cannabis law reform overseas, in particular cannabis legalization. So people might be aware that 11 states in the US have legalized cannabis, and Canada and Uruguay have also legalized cannabis. So a lot of our research has been looking at how those various reforms have worked out. And at the moment, I mean, the really slightly underwhelming conclusion is that it's really too early to tell the full consequences of cannabis legalization in those jurisdictions, just because a lot of the health and social effects are quite lagged. And also, all of those different jurisdictions use different regulatory approaches and also policy approaches. And there's also some complications in terms of their pre-reform policy and drug policy approach. So basically the evidence is rather inconclusive and uncertain at this time in terms of what will be the overall outcome of cannabis legalization here in New Zealand. But given the piecemeal data we've got and broad understanding of how reforms are playing out now, what I wanted to just briefly do is try and give you almost like a back of an envelope estimate of some of the effects, but being clear that this is back of the envelope, and a lot of the stuff I'm going to say is pretty preliminary data and pretty broad, some pretty broad estimates. Okay, so overseas, there's two areas where really clearly cannabis legalization has had an impact. The first one is, as you can imagine, reducing arrests for cannabis use. And so so probably in a lot of those jurisdictions that have legalized cannabis, about 70% less arrests for cannabis use. So you might note that I haven't said 100% reduce in arrests, because you still maintain some regulatory framework, and people that are underage and people that are breaking the rules are still arrested. So about 70% less arrests. The other area is tax. So obviously when you've got a legal market and you're taxing, you're earning some tax income. So for an equivalent country like New Zealand, tax, annual taxation from a legal cannabis market might be something like between 200 and 350 million per year. So again, just pointing out that these are pretty large ranges. So that just illustrates that a lot of the data and a lot of the outcomes are pretty preliminary. Okay, in terms of the black market, so if you legalize cannabis, that impacts the black market. But overseas experiences, again, that about 50% of the black market is reduced. So people often think that once you legalize cannabis, you'd completely eliminate the black market. But the experience overseas is that some proportion of the black market continues on, just because you've got your youth market, your underage market that you're providing for, or people that just don't want to work in the legal market. In terms of health impacts, so again, we're at a very preliminary stage in terms of seeing the outcome of the impact of legalizing cannabis in terms of how that affects adult use levels, and in particular youth levels. So the evidence is pretty mixed at this time, but we would say that given that you're going to have legal availability and normalization over time, it seems reasonable to us to expect some increase in use and harm. And we'll put that figure somewhere, maybe about $100 million per year in increase in harm from cannabis. That's probably one of the most controversial areas. It seems that over time that you would get increasing use and some increase in harm. And the other really important effect is you might be able to expand drug treatment. So through reducing social stigma and making treatment more available and reducing some of the barriers to treatment, you might be able to increase the level of treatment. Maybe you'd treat almost a third more people than you would under a prohibition exam. So the point there, I mean, I'm not suggesting that you add up all those figures and decide if it's net or not, but one of the things to think about when you're deciding on this issue is what of those five criteria, tax, reducing arrest, reducing the black market, reducing health and social harm, and expanding drug treatment are really important to you. So for example, if I was a business person, I might say, well, I'm most interested in the tax side of it, and $250 million from cannabis tax, that's pretty important to me, and that seems like a pretty good figure. So I might be more likely to support legalization. Whereas if I'm strictly a public health person, I might look at that increase in use and the extra $100 million in harm and say, well, $100 million in extra cannabis-related harm, you know, that's a big figure. And also health and social harm is something that's very important to me. So I'd be less likely to support cannabis legalization. And of course, we might have a view on all those five different criteria, but how we balance and how we put a relative weighting on it will decide how we decide on this issue. So if I was just purely a businessman, as I said, I would focus on those economic benefits in terms of taxation and employment and be supportive. Whereas if I was interested in some of the other thing, mostly with the health and social harm, I'd be less likely to support.
Can I just ask you one just quick question? With that $100 million, are you saying $100 million above what we already would spend on cannabis harm at the moment? It's an extra $100 million, is it?
That's right. So I should have said at the moment, it's been estimated that the health and social harm of cannabis per year is something like $1.3 billion. So we would say that that by legalizing cannabis, it would add probably about $100 million in terms of harm.
Thanks very much, Chris. Right, so we'll come to you, James. I know you've written on this, so let's hear your point of view. QC, James Farmer.
Thank you, and good evening, everyone. Well, look, I really appreciate those two openings that we've heard so far, and I think there were things in both of them, points in both of them that were not only interesting, but that I would either agree with or disagree with. I think my position is really that my main concern about cannabis legal reform is that I am very worried about the effect of cannabis on the teenagers who use it, and on the readiness of teenagers, or the greater ability of teenagers to develop psychosis and even right through to schizophrenia. And I think there's not much real dispute about that. And so the question really is, well, what can we do about it? And in particular, will the cannabis bill make any difference? Will it assist when, as I think Kylie readily acknowledged, even under the new law, if it happens, it is still prohibited for teenagers to use cannabis. And in fact, they are subject to an infringement notice, to a fee of $100, I think, to a fine of up to $200. Although they can escape that if they readily agree to go to get therapeutic assistance. And that, I want to come back to that point, because it seems to me the really beneficial role that the criminal law can have is not in putting people in jail. And I couldn't agree more that putting 17-year-olds into jail for using cannabis is absurd. And I would hope that that's not happening now these days. I'm sure it has happened in the past. But I think that's not to say that it shouldn't still be some kind of offence for people to use cannabis. And if they do, then we have to ask the question, well, are we going to enforce that law or not? And if so, how are we going to enforce it? And what really appeals to me, and I've remarked on it in recent stuff that I've written about this, is the amendment that was made last year to the Misuse of Drugs Act, which gives the police power, and more than power, it actually directs them, in the case of a user of cannabis, or use of any drug, not just cannabis, it directs them to not to prosecute and not to take the case to court if it's not in the public interest to do so. And in particular, whether it's not in the public interest to do so is basically fashioned or directed to directed towards a health, I'm just reading the words, health-centered or therapeutic approach. In other words, if it's thought by the police, and I'll come back to the police in a minute, if it's thought by the police that a therapeutic approach, therapeutic treatment or whatever it might be, counselling, is likely to deal with a problem user of drugs, then they should take that course. And in effect, the person charged would have the option. You can go to court if you like, you can be convicted, or you can go down this other track and avoid the courts altogether. And that's been very much the experience too in Portugal, where they have actually got a machinery for sending people who have drug problems into sort of counselling sessions, where they are assisted by professional people, psychiatrists, lawyers, doctors, into finding solutions to the particular problems that they have, and particularly, as I say, with young people. So my sort of view about the role of the criminal law is not the black and white one I think that Kylie's been talking about, the traditional one. It's more using the criminal law as a backstop, as if you like, as an incentive to motivate people to take a less drastic alternative, and one which is health-centered. And so that provision was passed. It's actually law now, and there's very little talk about it. I did hear a doctor talking briefly about it the other day, and he said, well, the records so far is that the police are not really using these powers. Well, they probably aren't, because to use Chris's point, it's early days. And really the police do need resources, they do need assistance, they do need expertise to help them make that provision work. But I, as I say, I think it provides the balance that we need to have between the law on the one hand and sort of getting a health reform or health treatment on the other hand. The other matter I did want to comment on, perhaps briefly, is the black market. And it would be 2 or 3 years ago now when I actually contacted members of the Green Party, who I've always thought were at the forefront of, right or wrongly, I've always thought were at the forefront of this sort of reform. And I said, well, you know, given the fact that there is such harm caused by cannabis in particular, what are your objectives in promoting legalization of it? And the answer that I got was that the main objective was eliminating the black market. And I think Chris has just given us a figure that 50% the black market still exists in these countries. He's given a figure of 50%. I've seen a figure that in Canada, the 39%, only 29%, sorry, only 29% of current cannabis users are buying their product from a legal source. So the black market, if that figure is correct, the black market is still alive and well. And the reasons for that, you see that on the American experience, which is that the black market is quite capable of competing with a regulated market. And it has certain advantages over the regulated market, because the regulated market is one that is, like all regulation, it's difficult. But in particular, it has costs, quite heavy costs associated with complying with regulation. And that's, again, been particularly true in Canada. Costs of record keeping, costs of having proper stores, costs of complying with the you know, the legal requirements as to how the cannabis is produced, et cetera, et cetera. And then, of course, on top of that, the legal suppliers, growers and suppliers, pay tax. Black market doesn't pay tax, and I'm not saying that's a good thing, but what it does mean is that the black market has a cost advantage, and it also has an advantage that it's able to provide to those people who want it. It will be able to provide a product that has greater potency than the regulation allows for legal suppliers. So, and then the other advantage that, again, this is based on American experience, is that the black market has, where they have been, felt they were in danger of losing their market or a share of their market in cannabis, they have produced or supplied other drugs, harder drugs, such as heroin, at a cheaper price and a more powerful product. And for those who are really looking for that, don't want to pay as much or want something that's stronger, that's an attractive alternative suddenly to them that maybe wasn't there before, because heroin was, generally speaking, a higher cost product than cannabis. And the result of that has been the number of drug deaths, and I'm talking all drug deaths, in those states, or some of those states in the United States, has gone up. And we're largely spared from the evils of heroin in this country, because heroin's an imported product and it's more difficult to get it here. The scourge that we have to face, of course, is methamphetamine. But the point I'm making is that the black market will not lightly and easily give up the position it's had, and it has a number of alternative ways of maintaining its position and indeed perhaps improving its position. So that's another point I really wanted to make at this point.
We might stop there, James, because you've done a great job, and we'll come back to the black market and the points that you've raised. I just want Imada to give her overview, and then we've got a lot of points we'll come back to, the health issues, the youth, the addictions and all that sort of thing. So Imada, over to you.
Yeah, hi, kia ora everyone. Welcome panelists, thanks for your speeches, and welcome the audience. Panelists before me focused on broad arguments for and against legalization, so I thought maybe I will zoom in to actually what is proposed in the bill and tell you what I like and maybe what I like to see improved in that bill, the particular reform that we will be voting on. So, because generally, sometimes people think we have a choice between prohibition, decriminalization, and legalization. But the fact is that there's many different shades to these different policies and different forms we can see legalization. We can have alcohol-like legalization, which is very commercial. Alcohol is very available in New Zealand. Or we can have tobacco-like legalization, which with stricter controls, or we can have some not-for-profit models, which are, or public monopolies, which are generally perhaps more public health oriented. So our bill is also, it aims to address the public health issues around legalization. And what I like about the bill is that it's evident that there is a lot of, the policymakers thought a lot about how to make this legalization address concerns around public health, around normalization and so on. So for example, there are limits on potency. So this is a chance to regulate how potent the legal cannabis will be. And the specific limit that is proposed is 15% for the flower. Do I love the 15% limit? Probably not, because it's at the higher end of what we know is sold on the black market. But I guess it's a compromise between that black market and encouraging people who currently use cannabis to transition to the legal regime. But there is that power to adjust that potency limit. And we know that higher potency, use of higher potency is linked to worse health outcomes and issues that we will be talking about. Now, there's also the limits around who can access cannabis. So we know the age is set around at 20. So that's interesting because some people are for it, some people are against it. Some people argue that there should be more consistency with legal alcohol purchase limit. Now, I personally like the 20 age limit. I don't have particular problem with that lack of consistency, because honestly, I think at some stage in the future, it will be more consistent and we will get to that 18 probably. There's also a ban on advertising. That's positive to see. So policymakers thought about it. No advertising is allowed under the bill. There's also taxes and levies. That's part of that is ring-fenced to treat harm reduction and treatment, which is also encouraging to see. There's even the annual cap on the total amount of products that will be produced on the market. So a new agency will be established if the referendum passes, the Cannabis Regulatory Authority. And every year, with some expert input, they will set how much cannabis can be produced on the legal market. So there's a lot of thinking about how to control this market and how to make it prevent that normalization and address some of these concerns. So I like this, that there is a limit of potency and the power to adjust that. There are age restrictions. There is the ban on advertising. There is the power to collect taxes, levies, and there's that annual production limit. So this shows that there's thinking about how to address some of these issues. Now, what is concerning, I guess Kylie talked about it a little bit, is to what extent we will be able to successfully execute it. So there will be a lot of work involved in executing such a tightly controlled, regulated market, and that will be a challenge. And I'm sure that the regulators, the civil servants who put the bill together, they should be proud of themselves, but the hard part is about to come, really. So that will be something challenging. Also, another thing that I am concerned about is that essentially the bill establishes a commercial market. What we know from the evidence from the research on tobacco, from the research on alcohol, is that over time, this commercial industry is likely to try and push back on some of those measures. This is what I mean when I said that age limit, perhaps in the future will be lower, because from the industry, we might see that pushback. And that is something I am slightly worried about. There are some measures in the bill that aim to prevent the big companies being on the market. So for example, there is the ban on the same company both producing and retailing cannabis, so that prevents vertical integration of companies. There's also provisions that say no company will be able to produce more than 20% of that annual production. So there are these provisions. But I am worried about these commercial interests. And finally, something that I need to mention here is another thing that I like about the bill. It's around social equity provisions. So there are some provisions in the bill that aim to encourage inclusion of not-for-profit operators and community-oriented operators who would participate in the market, but they would be obliged to, for example, partner with communities that have been disproportionately affected by prohibition, partner with Maori, create jobs, have that commitment. And there are provisions, there are license criteria that these should be included in that new market. However, again, I am concerned to what extent this will actually happen on the ground, to what extent these operators will be able to compete with the commercial companies who will maybe dominate the market. So in summary, I think there was a lot of thinking about addressing these public health concerns, making sure the cannabis will be safe, will be limited, the access will be limited, no advertising, that we have a tightly regulated market. But at the same time, I am worried about the extent of work needed to execute it effectively on the ground, as well as the commercial interests. Thank you.
Thanks, Marta. So I want to dig down to some issues now, and I think all speakers mentioned this issue, and it's one that you hear a lot, and it's a health issue. And I'll maybe start with you on this, Chris, because you've done a lot of research. What is the state of the medical research in terms of the effects of cannabis on adolescents? And Kylie mentioned it, and James mentioned it, and you to some degree too, Marta, adolescents compared with adults. I mean, that's obviously a concern for lots of people, and Kylie mentioned as a parent's a concern. So what is the evidence? Does it have worse effects for young people than it does for adults? And do you think the bill does enough to address that? Chris, I'll start with you.
Yeah, well, this is, I mean, the first thing I'd say is people often ask me, is this more harmful than alcohol, tobacco? And I think the first thing to keep in mind is a lot of the harm depends on frequency of use, right, who you are, and how much you use, and any pre-existing problems you've got. So there's no blanket, like one substance is more lower risk than the other. But I think it's really... There is, and for most people that are using, most adults that are using cannabis, cannabis has fairly mild health risk. So particularly if you're an occasional user, the health risks are really mild and are probably much lower than tobacco and probably even lower than alcohol. But having said that, I mean, and it's always hard to get this balance right, is there are vulnerable at-risk populations. And the research clearly says that one of those at-risk, vulnerable populations is young people, particularly if you, what we call an early onset user. So when you begin using cannabis at a very young age, in your 12 to 14 years old, then there's really significant harmful developmental and health consequences in terms of the chance that you're going to become dependent, use other drugs, your level of educational achievement and your employment prospects. But I guess I would temper that a little bit about the whole idea. I mean, the people that are advocating for legalization, I mean, I know Kylie will support this, is that everyone recognizes that. And one of the real tantalizing prospects for the legalization of cannabis is that you could reduce, is that you will endeavor to reduce access to young people underage by legalizing for adults and then focusing on preventing access to youth. The other group that's really at risk is people that have pre-existing mental health problems in their family, or they've already had a mental illness, or they've also had maybe an alcohol and drug dependency. And the final at-risk group is people that are using cannabis daily or near daily levels. So a little bit about, just like alcohol, you know, if you're using high frequency, high levels, then you're much more likely to have harm. But one interesting thing I just want to leave you with is, even amongst daily cannabis users, and this is the high risk group, that about 50% of those daily users don't report any problems at all, any health or social impacts.
Do you think though, just to dig a wee bit deeper there, do you think that because it can be easily available in the house? I mean, I know, much to my chagrin, when I was about 13 or 14 going to a friend's place and drinking what I thought was punch, but it was full of alcohol. And I came home drunk before my father gave me hell of a telling off. But with it being available in the house, does it mean there's a more potential for 14 and 15 year olds to see, oh, there's some stash in the drawer there, and because that the use will go up slightly for a period of time, and they're more likely to start getting into it, which they mightn't otherwise have done if it wasn't available?
Well, I think it's another way of looking at it is to be really careful about, a lot of those things already happened under prohibition. So it's not the case that we're in under prohibition, there's no cannabis use. So cannabis is out there in the community now and people are using it, and they're in, and unfortunately it's in households, and some young people will start using it because of that. So the real question you've got to ask yourself is, will legalization and strict regulation, and that's what the government's proposing, will that improve from what the status quo we have now? And again, those in favour of legalisation, I'm sure they would argue that if we legalise, then more effort could be focused in on and addressing those youth and access by children, by basically changing resources and also getting adults involved in regulating it, just like we did alcohol. But yes, I mean, that's one of the reasons when I talked about the harm, the health and social harms of legalization, that, you know, the reality is you're probably going to get a little bit more use and there could be those health harms. But remember, you balance that off against a whole lot of other objectives. And one of the key objectives, again, I think Kylie will talk about, is eliminating what some people would argue be needless arrests and convictions that stay with people for a long time. And also you've got to think about, is the penalty proportionate to the crime? So we all accept that if you drink alcohol and you make a nuisance or you get into a fight, then that's fine, you can be arrested. But under prohibition for cannabis, we're saying that anyone who's using cannabis at any level is liable to be arrested and convicted, and they'll keep that conviction for the rest of their lives. So a key question is to ask yourself, is that a proportionate penalty for that kind of behaviour?
Thanks. I'll come to you first, James, and I want to come back to Cotter, because I think, James, you showed quite a bit of concern about the youth and addiction. Marta raised the point of, you know, the enforceability of, you know, it's a good intention over 20s and we're going to control it and we're going to have all the... Are you convinced by that, James? Do you think that's going to do it, or do you have some concerns? Because I got an impression you still have some concerns about that.
Well, yes, I do. And you know, there is a major problem, obviously, about adolescent use, because I think it is accepted by everyone that the dangers in terms of development, intellectual development, and mental development, are huge. Can I just pick up on that last point, though, about needless arrests and convictions and the proportionality of that? Look, as I think I said earlier, I couldn't agree more that for mere use, as opposed to illegal supply, for mere use of cannabis, then the notion of people going to jail, whether they're teenagers or adults, is absurd. But go back to the amendment made last year to the Misuse of Drugs Act. The criminal law still has a part to play there if we use it properly. I mean, we all know that the police traditionally have had a discretion in relation to any crime as to whether they actually carry through with the prosecution. And I think, for me, that's the area we really should be focusing on.
All right, thanks, Jane. So, Kylie, your hat with your mother's hat on and your criminal justice hat, are you feeling there's enough safety nets there, or are you seeing it as a trade-off anyway, that there'll be some risk to younger people, but the trade-offs are stronger, or is it that you think there's enough protection, or a mixture of those things?
A mixture of that. I think Chris described those trade-offs really well in a stellar answer, which is that it's currently unlawful for young people. It will remain unlawful. So I think the only risk in terms of an increase in use by young people would be potentially normalisation, the effect of normalisation, or particularly, you know, perhaps contamination by adults who in their households who are currently not using that will use. But the patterns from other jurisdictions don't play that out. The biggest upsurge, and which is generally temporary, is actually people your age, Mark, who want to use cannabis either to relive their youth or their time at university, or for therapeutic potential.
I've with a lot of hopheads, and I know what it's like. I'd
agree, of course, to the extent that that we know from the research. And so one of the things we need to be wary of is, of course, that and Chris has made this point before, is that notwithstanding that cannabis is legalized in a number of jurisdictions, not for long enough that we have a really large body of research. So it's somewhat limited by its illegality. So that's kind of a catch-22. But I think we all agree that early onset use, and I'm not sure anyone mentioned age, but we're talking about before the age of 15, daily use there is a causal connection between that and really negative mental health outcomes. But I'm still more concerned, that's still a subset of a subset. As Chris mentioned, even amongst daily users, it's not a foregone conclusion that you're going to end up with the high end psychosis or potential link with schizophrenia. What you are going to end up with, which I've mentioned already, is a disconnection from school, disconnection from family, loss of, I'm trying to think of a better way to say it, joie de vivre, you know, an idea that you know, things aren't going well in your life if you are using cannabis heavily at the age of 13 or 14. I work with young people, young Māori people in prison. Every single one of them has been Not one of them has survived halfway through year 9 at high school, and every one of them has used cannabis prior to that age. So, there is usually a link that it is related to disconnection from school and community. And so it's not necessarily a health outcome, but the social outcomes also from early use means that something else is wrong in your house. It's more of a care and protection issue than it is a justice one at that stage. That if young people have access and don't have the barriers in their life to get them back on track, then that's your problem. And will legalization make a difference to that? Potentially, by helping kids stay in school, by increasing access, parental knowledge about complaint and about problematic use and what can be done about it. But also the public health education that's hopefully, and that's Marta's, I think, quite right in saying, again, this is a question about implementation. Is that actually going to happen? Mm-hmm. I hope so. You know, that we will have better public health education, not just about cannabis, but about, you know, other harmful substances for young people. So, you know, to some extent, it is six of one, half dozen of the other. There can be negative outcomes. Are those negative outcomes likely to improve? On balance, I think yes.
Thanks, Kaito.